The following is a conversation with Professor Nada Hamad, a senior staff specialist in bone marrow transplant, clinical and laboratory hematologist at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, where she also is director of the Hematology Clinical Trials Unit. She is also the president of the Bone Marrow Transplant and Cellular Therapy Society of Australia and New Zealand, and she is a senior lecturer at the University of Sydney and University of New South Wales.
We talk about transplant and cellular therapy in Australia and New Zealand, equality and diversity, access and different training pathways.
And now enjoy this conversation with Professor Nada Hamad.
My laptop is making a lot of noise, which is not good for a podcast. So I tried restarting it again and it's still doing it. So I'm going to try and see what happens.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. Thank you for your time.
Okay.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah. It must be late with you. It must be quite late with you, is it?
It is 9:30. So it's not so bad. My European meetings, I think there was an EBMT meeting at 3 o'clock in the morning earlier this week, and I just couldn't make it. Like, I tried really hard.
Wow.
It was not possible, but anyway.
Okay, well, firstly, thanks for giving up your time to talk to us, particularly at 9:30 on a Wednesday evening. And clearly you've had a very interesting journey to where you are today. Can you tell us a bit about your background and training and how you first became interested in transplant and cellular therapy?
Oh, wow, that's a very long story. So I'll keep it short. I was born in the Middle East to biracial parents, and they moved around a lot. My mother was a designer, my father was an architect, so we moved around the world a lot and I traveled a lot. I somewhat finished school early, and I won't tell you how early, but early enough that I really had the opportunity to travel and live in multiple countries and study in various places. So I first started medicine in the Czech Republic, and I did a few years there. And then I decided to take a break and move to New Zealand and did a degree in forensics. And I worked in forensics for a short period of time, at which point I realized that although I love the science of forensics and love science in general, I really miss people. And forensics is a lot more, I guess, an independent science, we can say. So I went back to medicine, and I moved to Australia from New Zealand to do that. And I think one of the things that attracted me to hematology was potentially the reason I said, I'm never going to do it. I remember a distinct moment in medical school in my first week, and I had a clinical tutorial with a hematologist, and we'd walked in, and unfortunately a patient had passed away unexpectedly. And he was so impassioned and so distressed by this that, you know, it really shocked a lot of us as students, because we'd never seen anything like that. And I thought to myself, I don't think hematology is for me. And I came full circle and ended in hematology, mostly for the attraction of the ability to really have a significant impact on patients' lives in terms of survivability of cancers. Oncology is appealing in that way, but hematology has this, you know, ability to really cure patients with some extraordinary technology, which is what transplant is for me. It's a science, it's an art, and an opportunity to really have significant impact on patients' lives. So transplant was a clear direction for me. And I went to Canada to train specifically in transplant after my training in Australia. And I came back home for the beaches and the sun and the people and the friends and the family. And that's where I've been ever since. So now I'm a transplanter in Sydney, Australia. And, you know, my passion for transplant clearly has led me to a lot of leadership positions. So I'm the president of the Australia and New Zealand Transplant and Cell Therapy Society as well.
And why did you go to Canada for training in BMT? Why didn't you stay in Australia or go to New Zealand?
Australia and New Zealand are geographically quite large, and so we have a public health system that covers local care more than centralized care. So there's multiple smaller transplant centers. So there's 11 allogeneic stem cell transplant centers in Australia and New Zealand. There's only 3 in New Zealand and the rest are in Australia. And there's, you know, a few more now that are doing smaller numbers of transplant billing, but in general, most centers don't do really high volume transplants. And we haven't had dedicated transplant fellowships. And that's not a standard training scheme. So most people go overseas to high volume centers where there are established fellowship programs. So I went to Canada to Princess Margaret Hospital, which has a bone marrow transplant fellowship under the University of Toronto. And it's a fantastic program, and it was an opportunity to really sink my teeth in and get some really good training and good exposure to a high volume center.
And let me just ask another question. Maybe I hope it's not too personal, but I didn't get, why did you go to Czech Republic? And then, because it's in a really odd like direction from one place to another. What was the reason?
The only
person
who's ever asked me why the Czech Republic, because it was to some extent on a whim, and it's not too personal in the sense that I'd lived in the UK at the time, and I was actually on holiday in the Czech Republic. I was in Prague with my family, and there's a very big difference between London and Prague. they're very different cities. And I was enamored by it. I remember being on a tour bus where they talked about Charles University being one of the first medical schools in Europe. It's a beautiful place, beautiful city. I inquired, I got in, and I thought, why not? So I learned a new language, lived in a new city. It was an extraordinary experience. And I think my love of travel and my love of moving from one place to the next really comes from my background and my family and my parents. We've lived all over the world before then. So It wasn't really a challenge for me to move or to consider learning a new language. And Czech was interesting and challenging because I, before then, spoke Arabic and English and French, and it was, you know, it was intriguing. So I did, I moved.
So you can actually speak Czech?
Yes, very badly now. Wow. Because it's been a long time.
Wow. Okay. Impressive.
You've probably alluded to some of them in what you've said about rural areas and few centers and things. But what for you are the main challenges to working in transplant in Australia and New Zealand?
I wouldn't say that challenges in transplantation in Australia and New Zealand are unique to Australia and New Zealand. Most of them are the usual clinical challenges we face. But Australia and New Zealand, because of geography and rural areas and regional areas and the focus of the healthcare system on delivering care locally to patients, means that patients have to travel quite some time to get to a transplant center in certain circumstances, because most of the transplant centers are centered in metropolitan areas. So we can service those areas quite easily. And we endeavor to offer our services to everybody who needs a transplant. That's the whole point of a public health system. But unfortunately, there's no way around it. The geographic challenges pose a problem for patients. They don't have the family members that can be with them during that period of time. And it is a long period of time. You know, you have to come to hospital for a month and you need to be near a transplant center for the first 3 months usually. So there is relocation, there is disconnection from your family, from your support networks. And so those challenges mean that we have to work extra hard to make sure access is equitable. And I think that's a challenge to most public health systems, but I feel in Australia and New Zealand, we do have a really big geographic area that we have to cover. And also there's cultural differences between, you know, who lives in those areas. So in certain circumstances, there's significant disadvantage to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander or First Nation people in Australia and to some extent in New Zealand as well.
And do you have some certain infrastructures in place for, because you said people need to travel sometimes a lot. And I just heard from the US that people there have certain like hotels near the hospital where, when for instance it's in a pediatric setting, that the family can travel with a child and then receive the transplant but always be near the patient? Do you have some kind of certain infrastructure as well?
Yes, it depends on the hospital and the region we're talking about, because Australia, you know, there's different health systems. We've got a state and a federal healthcare system. So each state has its own infrastructures and they're not the same all across the country.
Yeah.
But in general, people appreciate that transplantation requires relocation if you live far away. And so most hospitals will facilitate social work support and social support networks locally for patients wherever possible, including accommodation services. And even with those services and even with those supports, it can still be a challenge for patients. It's, you know, and I, in what comes to mind is, you know, patients with young families, you know, a mother or a father that has to leave their family where they have to stop working. Who's going to pay the bills? Who does that shared work at home? You know, young children going to school, they really can't relocate. So there is a pressure on these patients, even if we can support them with accommodation, even if we can support a whole family relocating, it's still quite challenging. And some people choose not to sometimes, which is unfortunate, but when they do, it's still hard for them more than most.
And do people travel from one state to another to like change healthcare, like accessibility? Because sometimes when you just said that, that there are differences from state to state, I think that's a main European centristic problem that we always think, for instance, in Germany, there is no difference between let's say Hamburg in the north and Munich in the south. But in Australia is a huge, huge continent and you have huge differences. So how do you manage that as a whole, as a country?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say there's a difference necessarily in the healthcare structures or quality or access. So that's there. But you're right, it's a very big country. So in some circumstances where there's a border, and there's an equipoise between the distance, if you go north to your border or south to your border, there is a level of agreement between between states that sometimes it's closer to cross one border than it is to come to the center that's much south of the border. And the area that I'm thinking of in Australia is in very north New South Wales, where to get to a Sydney center is much further than going to your nearest Queensland center, which is just north. So sometimes it is clear that it's more advantageous for a patient to cross a border. And we negotiate that between the states. There is agreements that facilitate that. COVID has been certainly a challenge to that collegiality and that harmony between states, because in an attempt to control COVID community transmission, we locked external international borders, but also internal borders, depending on community transmission in each state. So some states didn't have as much community transmission as others, and so they closed their borders to each other. And when that happened, there was a challenge between how do we navigate this for patients? You know, if you have a donor in Queensland, how do you get them to New South Wales for their sibling and vice versa? Or if we had patients who needed to go to Queensland, where before they could easily do that, they couldn't anymore because there was a closed border. So they, you know, we had to clearly quickly come up with systems to create exemptions for healthcare needs. And all of a sudden transplant doctors were writing letters about what transplant is and why people needed to cross the border and for how long and why did they need to keep going back and forth and why did their family need to go? So these are things we didn't have to do before, but COVID really highlighted when this, you know, system has been going on for ages, you know, invisibly, we didn't even really feel it, all of a sudden became very clear and had to be, delineated. We actually had to write it down. That was an interesting experience. And certainly CAR T-cell therapy is even more challenging because it's a novel technology. It's not available in every center, or at least in every state, like allogeneic bone marrow transplant. And so when we started commercial CAR T-cell delivery to patients in Australia, there were a handful of centers and they were not in every state. So people did have to go from one state to the other to access it.
And obviously yourself, you talked about doing a fellowship in Canada. Now training for trainees in Australia and New Zealand who are interested in transplant and cellular therapy, the majority of them tend to go abroad to do different fellowships, or do people stick around, or is it a bit of a mix? Is there any sort of specific?
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad because I really loved my experience in Canada. It was a fantastic center to learn in. It was an opportunity to see things done differently in a different way. Everywhere you go, they do things a little bit different and you open your mind to new ways and new ideas. But also from a personal perspective, you know, traveling and doing something fun and learning and working at the same time is one of the joys of being in that position in your training where you're finished, but you're not committed to being in a permanent role. So there's a little bit of flexibility. So that's really the best time to go out and seek those experiences. And in the first year of COVID, we closed our borders internationally. So people couldn't leave and people couldn't come in. And the couldn't leave part was because if you did leave, you had to go through so many, you know, hoops or jump through so many hoops to come back in. And people didn't want to leave their loved ones in the midst of the crisis. You know, it was very hard to understand what was happening and for how long that might be. There were a lot of Australians and citizens and residents who had a hard time coming back, and there still are some even now. So people or trainees didn't really feel like it was okay to go, even though those positions, you know, were available and many people wanted to go. That desire is still there. So in the first year, I think training kind of was a little bit stifled for that year. And as president of the Australian New Zealand Transplant Cell Therapy Society, I'm always concerned about training and education. It's one of our major goals is to facilitate and promote training and interest in transplant. Because for some reason, you know, I feel that interest is not always there. Trainees find it perhaps a little bit intimidating or complex. And so, you know, I love it. I want to make sure trainees understand the beauty of it and why it's so rewarding. So we created scholarships for the BMT school, which was it wasn't very much, but it was a way to kind of illustrate that you can access education through EBMT and through the American Society of Transplant and Cell Therapies. There were many avenues to foster that interest and to get a little bit of training while the pandemic was going on. And the second thing is promoting fellowships in Australia and New Zealand. So fellowships are not that common because we're funded in Australia through the public health system for training positions. And fellowship positions are not discrete training positions. So they're usually, you know, funded by the hospital itself or through philanthropy. And so there's not that many of them around. So trying to, you know, promote fellowships coming through, we actually, during the crisis, added two more BMT and cell therapy fellowships nationally in that 1 year. So they started coming up. And I think even recently, I've just heard another one was set up in another state. So I think almost every state has a BMT fellowship position somewhere. And, you know, that's probably a result of the pandemic. So there's pros and cons.
But in Germany, in my university hospital, I had a rotation last month and I made the same observation that you did because people asked me, okay, where do you work? I said like stem cell transplant cellular therapy. And the response was, okay, that's quite specific. That's quite like really a niche, for instance. And people or even trainees, young people, they always want to go broad and broaden their perspective. And Then I tell always the story of the EBMT and the registry. That is one of the first big registries with a huge amount of data where you can explore all the diseases, therapies, etc. And then they were like, whoa, okay, never heard of that. Quite interesting. And do you have in Australia and New Zealand also this kind of registry database?
Yeah. Yes, we do. And it is also one of the first in Australia and New Zealand, one of the largest and most successful. And I think this is unique to transplant, that we, you know, when transplant came about, it was very experimental. It was very risky as a procedure. And, you know, I always think those people were so brave, those clinicians and doctors so brave to kind of pursue this really high-risk procedure with the potential to save lives. And, you know, it's really quite vogue or chic now to say, you know, immune therapy, you know, we're saving lives with immune therapy, we're harnessing the immune system. We did that in transplant way, way back in the 60s and 70s. And I think people forget that transplant is not necessarily a subspecialty hematology. It's a tool in hematology. We harness the immune system really early on in a scientific way and applied it for curative intent to cure multiple hematological cancers. And in fact, it's probably the treatment modality that has the greatest potential for cure for the greatest number of patients. So that is extraordinary that we have been incrementally improving outcomes in transplant through these registries. We really make every patient's story count. Every single patient we put on the registry, that individual patient has, you know, their journey, their story, their outcomes influences how we transplant forevermore. So this kind of constant looking at data, reviewing outcomes, improving is also slightly different in medicine. We don't do that all the time. We do a lot of clinical trials prospectively because that's the gold standard, but we don't put all patient stories and journeys and outcomes into one repository and question it and review it and, you know, ask various questions at various times. Even though the transplant was done in 1970 or 1980 or even 1990, we still get information out of that. And that's fantastic. You know, the power of big data was harnessed in transplant even before big data was such a big deal and so interesting. And I always say to people that transplant is for those early adopters, for those trailblazers who want to, you know, create a path in a career in medicine and hematology. So it's a philosophical, I guess, way of looking at it, but scientifically very rewarding to be able to access so much data so quickly through registries.
Definitely. And thinking about clinical trials, obviously you're heavily involved with clinical trials yourself. In terms of trainees who are interested and want to be involved, want to learn about clinical trials, what advice do you have for those people?
I think, you know, clinical trials is something that people really put high on a pedestal, that's the holy grail of science and research, which it is, because it has the capacity to really answer one specific question with a lot of clarity, or as much clarity as we can get in medicine and in science. But if you're interested in that kind of research, you really have to learn how to conduct research. And you could get opportunities to participate in those clinical trials, depending on where you are. So if you're in centers where there's lots of clinical trial activity and you find a mentor who's going to take you through it and support you and let you, you know, so to speak, get your training very quickly in an environment that's supported, that's great. But if you don't have access to that, don't lose that drive to conduct research, and conduct research in whatever capacity that you have, wherever you are. So my advice to trainees is a couple of things. Find a good mentor who also has an interest in research. Make it known that you have an interest in research and do whatever it is that you can wherever you are. So, you know, most people look forward to try and go somewhere or do something big somewhere else, but They often forget that where they are, there is capacity to do very good clinical research and work. And some of my favorite projects are from, you know, my junior medical students who just really wanted to research and find a unique set of patients, either do a case series or a case report and develop a research question beyond that. So you can start small wherever it is that you are, and don't let that limitation that clinical trial is the only way you can answer a question stop you from pursuing that curiosity and that interest in research. I think that that curiosity for learning and for research, if you have it, it's not only rare, but it really should be nourished and encouraged. So you can do that for yourself, but certainly pursue mentors and supervisors who have that interest as well to help you nurture that.
And you said you had really early contact to hematology and transplantation, but in general, how does the BMT and cellular therapy training work in Australia and New Zealand? Is there a certain path?
So bone marrow transplant and cell therapies are covered within hematology. And, you know, not all centers have allotransplant or cell therapies, but they would all have hematological cancers as part of the training program. So you do rotations in different hospitals and different areas, depending on where your training is or where your training program is run. So you may come into contact with transplant as part of a team that works in a center with transplant, or you may be part of a team that refers to transplant centers. Most hematological malignancy centers will have to refer somewhere else. And a lot of the time I noticed that if you're not in a transplant center, you sometimes don't understand the intricacies of transplant, and it makes it a little bit mysterious. So you're not quite sure what's involved. You just know when you need to transplant someone, or when you need to refer, because you watch your clinical senior colleagues doing that, you know, going, yes, this person will need a transplant, we have to refer out. And then the opposite is true for centers that are very transplant heavy. So the trainees are rotating around many, many transplant centers. They don't quite appreciate when a patient needs to be transplanted, but they are very good at the transplant part of the process. So I think for trainees, the path is taking an interest and then pursuing it by moving to centers that either have transplant activity or pursuing fellowships after they finish their training in specifically in transplant, whether it's in Australia or internationally. So some people come to it very early that they want to do transplant, so they apply for hematology training in a transplant center, and others come to it afterwards. I certainly did. I wasn't intending on going into transplant, but worked at a transplant center incidentally, discovered it, loved it, and then pursued it more deliberately.
And I suppose the same would be true for CAR T-cell therapy now, because this is, we noticed in Europe that this is at the moment a major issue of inequality in training, because people, there are lots of trainees who would like to see one CAR T-cell therapy, but have no access to it.
Yes, this inequality of training is a very good point. And I think for me, COVID highlighted it even more, because as you locked down, we were more constrained in our movement. So people weren't able to move enough. We had some staff shortages. So the rotation process was restricted. So people had to stay where they were for a bit longer. And so then exactly that, there is an inequity in exposure, because you can create equity in training by making sure everybody has a good baseline knowledge. And one of the strategies I used to impart that is about in 2017, I did a needs analysis with trainees in one of our national conferences. And many trainees said they just didn't feel like they had the breadth of exposure in hematology and didn't really quite have a good grasp of clinical hematology. It was all dependent on what they saw in their rotations. And in Australia, hematology training is pathology and clinical hematology combined. And the pathology component has an exam. So people are always, you know, trying to pass their exams in pathology, but there's no exam in clinical hematology. It's all by exposure and the apprenticeship model. And so we designed an online hematology education program, a national hematology education program in Australia and New Zealand, to try and lift up that common denominator, to try and impart that basic curriculum about why we do certain things. You know, even if you don't have a lymphoma heavy center, what are the principles of lymphoma treatment and where are we going with all the new technology? There are modules in transplant and modules in cell therapy. So for people who don't work in a cell therapy center can at least understand the principles of it, the basics, why we refer, when to refer. But you know, that is so important because at the very least, you're able to spark interest in those people who might never had experienced it. And we purposely designed it with a diversity of faculty members from across the country so that people could see clinicians who are interested in those topics and create connections or contact them if they wanted to work in a transplant center or in a cell therapy center or a lymphoma specific center. So although we have an inequity in exposure, we can mitigate that inequity by creating curriculums. We can create online content people can access from anywhere. We can create connections or networks for people to access that are online. It used to be very much driven by who you know or who your mentor or supervisor knew, because they'd call up on your behalf and say, my fellow is fantastic, or my trainee's great, he wants to do, or he or she wants to do this. Can you please, you know, consider them for a position? And I think that's great, but not everybody has access to that. So opening up those processes, making them more transparent, allowing people to access that information more freely probably will improve that inequity more than anything else. It's impossible to make it exactly equal because no center is equal.
And from a pediatric point of view, so it sounds very much like the combined clinical and pathology side is in Australia is similar to what we have here in the UK. But for people out in Australia and New Zealand who go into pediatric hematology, do they tend to be like people who've gone into hematology first as adult trainees and then branched out into pediatrics? Or is it people just doing a bit of both? Or do you have people from the pediatric setting come into hematology training with the intention of being a pediatric hematologist at the end?
Yes, I think it's a mixed bag. So I have colleagues who were pediatricians and then decided to do hematology because there's no specific pediatric hematology program. You need to do basic pediatrics and then get into hematology, or adult physician training and get into hematology. So, you know, the paths come into it in different ways. I haven't myself come across someone who's done hematology and then decided to be a pediatrician. It's usually the other way around. You know, if you have a love for pediatrics, you either have it or you don't. You develop it quite early, I think, from my experience and from my colleagues. But what I do think is that pediatric trainees who go into hematology are extraordinary because they have the advantage of dealing with a very diverse population of patients and people. And my observation is they have the capacity to switch between patients and age groups really easily and naturally based on their training. And then they come into hematology, which is a predominantly adult setting. They also do pathology. And by the end of it, they're just so diverse in the way they think and the way they do things. You know, some of my most favorite people in the world are pediatric hematologists. And I noticed this in them a lot, that they're so good at problem solving for different settings, especially when there's, you know, complex issues in a patient context. I think it's an interesting path to take, and not a common path that's trodden.
But your concept of like try to find the right balance between equity, equality, was quite beautifully put and quite strongly realized with your educational program. And what we noticed when we had to look you up to prepare this this talk, we noticed that you're really, really passionate about fighting for equity, equality in medicine, and how this also extends far beyond the individual, the even gender problematic. But what advice would you give to trainees about this, right, really increasingly relevant issue nowadays?
So I'm going to start by telling you how I came to it, because this kind of passion I wasn't born with it, right? I, as I told you, I've traveled a lot. I'm multilingual. I've lived a lot of places, and it never really occurred to me it was a major issue. You know, I was young, I was free, I was doing all sorts of things that I enjoyed, and never really felt any constraints. And I think later in life, as I, you know, started to hit more blocks as my career was moving forward, I started to feel this friction, which I didn't quite understand. And I had a moment of epiphany when I became a patient, when I had my own children. And I really did feel a difference in how I was treated, or how I didn't feel like I was treated like I ought to. I'm a doctor, I'm a clinician. I kind of have a good understanding of the health system, and something wasn't quite right. And at the time, I didn't know what it was either. So in my experience, you know, there was a couple of comments that were very racially based that I didn't appreciate at the time. For example, I was consistently denied pain relief, and I just kept thinking, you know, this is really strange. You know, I work in hematology, you know, people in pain is a serious problem for us. And I thought, maybe this is just ONG, right? Maybe it's just women having children, people think that's okay. But, you know, a couple of nurses said the same thing to me on a couple of different shifts, and that was, you're going to be okay. You're fine. You can handle this. Your people are good at having children. And I didn't understand why anyone would say something like that. And it just, you know, I just ignored it. I was stressed trying to learn how to breastfeed, which is a whole other thing. But 10 years later, I went to an education session by a Black obstetrician who was talking about obstetric outcomes in women of color, and how, you know, this concept of pain relief denial was very common, and how obstructive outcomes were more likely to be negative because what they were saying was often not heard. And the penny dropped for me, and I was like, oh, I didn't realize that this is probably a cultural or system issue. You know, I thought this was an individual person making a rude comment, or an individual couple of people making some comments. And so I started to think a bit more critically about it. And, you know, once you're a scientist, you're always a scientist. So, you know, I started to think, well, what else in my training or in my clinic am I missing? And the more I thought about it, the more I noticed that in general in medical training, the concept of, you know, applying a certain language or a way of dealing with someone based on their own background isn't quite there yet. It's there in pediatrics to some extent, because you pitch how you speak to a patient depending on their age, you change the doses of medications based on their age, but we don't really do that in adult medicine in general. And I started looking into this a bit more and learning more about feminism, learning more about intersectionality and what that means. And just to keep it short, intersectionality is essentially considering that there are different various forms of privilege in our community and our society, and they can be gender, they could be race, they could be an accent, they can just be where you live. And all of those things combined can create all sorts of different biases and obstacles in a person's life or a patient's life. And I think that applies in medicine also. I think that's for sure true. And the more you think about it, the more it becomes obvious. You know, the patient who comes into a hospital with a wheelchair, who can't access the toilet, if they're waiting in your waiting area for, you know, 3 hours, as opposed to a patient who can just get up and walk and go somewhere else, that is a difference that is clinically relevant and meaningful in many situations. We're not attuned to that. And I thought, you know, as clinicians, we're very good at learning new skills. So being able to learn how to apply different strategies for individual patients is when it's in our wheelhouse. We just have to be willing to learn it. So my interests have now shifted to intersectional approaches to science, to research, to clinical practice, and to education, because all of those fields have always lacked that diversity in the people designing those systems. And the more you think about it, the more likely you will find deficiencies for particular groups of people. And as doctors, we want to do the best that we can for everybody, especially the most vulnerable. So if we start to think in an intersectional way, we're more likely to do the best that we can for the most vulnerable and to basically serve our community and society fairly, because at the end of the day, the healthcare system, although it services individuals, we're really here to serve the community and society as a whole. So it's the most efficient way to do it, in my opinion.
And do you think that it's been impacted by the pandemic at all?
Oh, yes. I think there's nothing like a crisis to really, highlight or amplify disadvantage. There is no doubt, even in Australia, that we've noticed that our rural and regional communities were more vulnerable. We centralize care in our metropolitan areas. We certainly have better access to ICUs, better access to all the healthcare services. And as soon as an area or a region is a little bit isolated, they're vulnerable, right? If you don't have that concentration of acute care services when COVID hits, that community is going to be at most risk. We have found that our Aboriginal communities, our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, have really suffered. When COVID does start to community spread, it has been much more challenging to either control that community spread or to support those communities with healthcare services. And like everything, there's always blind spots in the system. So if you notice any time, the pandemic gets worse or there's a wave, there's a fervor of organization from healthcare, public healthcare teams, public healthcare strategies. But all of those strategies, when you think about them, they all make sense when, people are on TV telling us what we should be doing. You should lock down, you shouldn't go out, you should go 2 kilometers, 10 kilometers. But it doesn't take very much to then go, oh, but what about this or what about that? If you don't have the people in the room in those systems that can ask those questions, then you miss a big part of the strategy. And one such example, for instance, when we created a lot of lockdowns and restrictions in movement, we decided to homeschool in Australia like everywhere else in the world. And I don't think it was quite obvious to the public health teams designing these strategies that the majority of the healthcare workforce is female. So they have to be at home homeschooling and they have to be at work. Well, who's going to look after the patients? So, you can't really be a nurse and work from home. You need to be in that intensive care unit. So how do you manage that? And if someone doesn't say, well, how do we cover that workforce? It takes you maybe 2 to 3 months to decide we're going to make childcare free and that it needs to be open to healthcare workers. And so it took a very long time for that to actually materialize, but it could have been done so much sooner to support the healthcare system and to support the women that were supporting the healthcare system. So, very small, blind spots have a really big impact. And I think COVID really highlighted that, both from a workplace perspective, but also from the patients we serve perspective.
But I suppose there are two really important things that you just mentioned. One is the visibility, to make things visible, to give people voices who already have one, for instance, but just to give them a platform. And the other thing is maybe for trainees, quite relevant, because that's what I noticed, at least here in Germany, is that there is a big danger to perpetuate certain behaviors, certain approaches, when people who are new to something, who could think of something differently, have no opportunity to realize that thought. So for instance, when we talk in Germany about, we also talk about the really problem about like rural general physicians. We don't have anyone from the younger generation who wants to do that because they don't have a clue what it's like to work there because they didn't go there. They went to a big city with a big university hospital and then they said, okay, I'll stay here. What is it like? Do you try to like send younger physicians to rural areas to maybe learn from a general physician there, or how does it work in your area?
This is an excellent point. What you were talking about then is you can't be what you can't see. So we're all more likely to pursue paths of the people we observe and admire, or at least it's a known path, so you can at least see yourself doing it. So that's just human nature. And there are strategies in Australia that are designed to retain trainees or doctors in rural services. So, you know, you can get scholarships to get into medical school, you know, with the incentive that you come back to work in a rural regional area. There are, you know, employment strategies around areas of need. So if you're an overseas trained doctor, you can get paths to training that, you know, go through the rural regional service areas, and people then experience those areas and decide to stay. I think, you know, this issue of highlighting experiences and voices is really an important one. And I think that goes to the art and the concept of inclusivity. So when we talk about EDI, equity, diversity, inclusion, we tend to think about disadvantaged groups because we want to focus or shed a light on those lived experiences so we understand more about these marginalized or more disadvantaged groups. However, inclusivity, I think, is a deliberate practice, and it's not necessarily just around disadvantaged groups. You get better results, you get more innovative results and ideas, the more inclusive you are in anything you do. So, you know, the more inclusive you are in the people you include in your circles, whether it's friends, whether it's colleagues, whether it's disciplines, you know, in hematology in the workplace, or it is a diversity of ideas. So including in your view, worldview, or your experiences, diverse experiences. So I often say to trainees, think of the thing that you just never thought of and do that. Do a little bit of that. Go to the place you didn't think you would. And it's hard because I can attest to the fact that it's hard going somewhere else to do something else you've never experienced before. And one of the things that I reflect on that I was very privileged to have experienced is that I traveled a lot when I was younger. My parents moved around a lot, so it was never really that hard a leap for me to do new things and go new places. But that's not the same for everybody. So some people just, you know, live in the one town, they go to school there, and they, you know, do their training there, and they stay there, they live there, they have a really beautiful family or a support network, and so there's no incentive to move. So generating these incentives for new experiences is really important. So when we're designing training programs, it's important to create different opportunities, public practice, private practice, rural practice, regional rotations, create a at least the opportunity for people to pursue that interest if they have it. You can't make people do things, but you can at least entice them, give them reasons to diversify their experience, and encourage it. But, you know, it's really important to encourage it. And a lot of trainees call me to say, look, I'm thinking about doing an international fellowship, but I've got kids and I've got a family, and I really, it sounds really hard. The paperwork is a lot. And I say, actually, it is hard. I mean, I moved to Canada with a 4-month-old baby, you know, suitcases and my husband, and, you know, finding apartments and fridges and things to pursue a passion and a new experience. But it's extremely rewarding. And that experience of doing something new actually does something to your brain. It allows you do not be so afraid of new things. And there's nothing better than that, because it allows you to be resilient. It's good for you. It's good for your family. It's good for your patients. It's good for everyone to try and think about things in a new way. You hear people's experiences differently when you have that capacity to think in different ways. So encouraging new experiences, encouraging rural regional practice is really, really important.
And at the end, what do you think are the main goals for you in your work, in your clinical work, in your personal work, or even as the president of the Australian New Zealand Society for Transplant and Cellular Therapy? What do you think will be your main goals? Because we can just repeat everything we just felt like the last 2 years, because everything you just said is like impacted and negatively influenced, obviously, by COVID. Isn't that so? So it's, yes, quite frustrating.
I think I've come full circle, because it's been a couple of years now, and you know, I don't know anyone who hasn't felt that COVID dampening of mood, of spirit, of, you know, of everything. And I think it's really important to be in a mindset of growth and learning. We're honestly here on this earth, all we can do is evolve, learn, and grow. And if you have that mindset, there's opportunities in every negative experience, in every crisis. And COVID has done one thing, at the very least for me, which is, you know, before COVID, I would fight really hard. You know, maybe we can make our workplace more gender friendly. Maybe we can have meetings at different times. Maybe we can change services a little bit. And it's really hard to go up that battle where everybody says, no, 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 we've always done it this way. It's impossible. Change is just impossible. And within no time at all, when COVID hit, everything could be virtual. Everybody knew how to learn, how to use virtual. Nobody complained, you know, I'd rather not have to go outside. I'm happy to do Zoom. I will learn it. So this experience for me is my argument for every change now. You say we can't change. Well, we did things pretty fast when there was a good reason to change. And if you don't want to change, chances are it's because you don't think that reason is good enough. So from an advocacy point of view, it's, for me, I just highlight, why isn't this good enough for you? Why isn't it important to promote gender equity, to promote fairness, to promote better services, to promote access, to promote safety? If you thought it was important, you would change, because we know we can change. There is undeniable proof. The whole world did the same thing at a drop of a hat. So that experience in my mind shines, because it helps me keep a positive outlook. Some of the good things that came out of COVID were, for example, the online training program that all of a sudden became very valuable for people. The connection that we made with international colleagues, because they were more than happy to do things by Zoom now, right? There is something quite extraordinary that I have made more international colleague connections in COVID than ever before, going to conferences, shaking individual hands, right? Or meeting people that I'd read about on paper. So this is, you know, a way of thinking for me now, you know, personally. It's a journey, it's learning. Always look for the positive side, leverage every positive that you can in a negative experience. And as far as goals, you know, the goalposts change. And I think, you know, once upon a time I had specific goals as a trainee. I needed to finish training. You gotta, you know, you have to keep moving towards something. Once you're in a position, you know, of permanence and you're in a, you know, a job, you've got patients to see, it's the same to some extent every day. It's really important to create your own vision and ideas and things that, you know, you want to move towards. Being president of Australian New Zealand Transplant Cell Therapies, the goals are quite clear. We want to promote quality services. We want to promote access. We want to promote education. And we want to promote a culture of equity, diversity, and inclusion. So those goals, to materialize them, does require an internal drive to keep pushing for those changes. And so my personal goal is to keep driving for those changes as much as I can, without burning out, because burning out is a real thing. But I think if you find joy in what you do, burning out is less of a risk. So find the joy in what you do is my advice. And I wake up every day trying to make sure that I find some joy in the things that I do.
Yeah, it's very impressive, all what you do. It's really, yeah, really astonishing. And we want to thank you very much for your time and for your willingness to join our little podcast. And we would be really happy if you, do you have a link to your online education program on hematology for trainees? Because I think I never heard of that before. And I think it's very valuable to other trainees to hear from that.
And actually we're in the process of setting one up, transplant and cellular therapy specific for through EBMT for trainees as well. So
we could learn from your experience and maybe share experiences, learn from one another. Would be really, really good.
Yeah. So our program is NHEP, National Hematology Education Program, .com.au, and it's free. I'm not sure if the access is open to all trainees, because you have to have a medical provider number in Australia, like a medical registration number, to access it. Mm-hmm. But certainly if there's an interest, we can create a pathway for international trainees who are interested. The content has a little bit of an Australian, New Zealand bent, because our access to drugs is very different. But the basic learning is fantastic. The speakers are excellent. They're internationally renowned speakers. It's free access. It was designed by a fantastic faculty, and it was funded through unrestricted grants from industry partners. So there's no editorial control from industry partners. It's just there as a positive contribution to education in hematology. And I would be very pleased or happy to assist in any way I can around education, specifically for BMT and cell therapies, because I think, good content is something that we really value now in this generation and in this era. And we've not always been the best at creating, engaging, maybe even a little bit entertaining content to bring people into our specialties. It can be quite boring if you're not trying to engage. So
yeah.
I congratulate you on setting up this podcast and bringing out voices for trainees to hear different ideas and different things. So well done to you. That's fantastic.